Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast, episode 14, Flying Machines and Box Office Falls. In this episode, we're going to be drawing a line between Italian Renaissance master Leonardo da Vinci and American action movie hero Bruce Willis. So yippee-ki-yay, let's get into it. First, we're going to need to look at a little bit of what we should know about Leonardo da Vinci. Of course, he's one of the most studied and known artists in the world. But just a brief overview, Leonardo da Vinci is an Italian polymath who excelled in various fields, art, science, engineering, math. He did a little bit of everything. He worked for the church. He painted the Last Supper. He had various notebooks that had vast collections of scientific observations, inventions, theories. He was a pioneer of engineering, so he conceptualized groundbreaking inventions, including prototypes for helicopters, which we'll get into later, tanks, submarines, and he really demonstrated his engineering prowess, which was really far above and ahead of his time. Of course, he also did a lot of anatomical dissections. So Da Vinci had meticulous anatomical studies and drawings based upon these dissections. And he kind of brought this advanced scientific knowledge of the human body that laid the foundation for modern medical understandings of how the body works. He also had this kind of mystical and strange side to him where he made these things called the codices, which were done with mirror writing, and they're an extensive collection of notebooks called the codices, and they have a bunch of his writings and sketches, and many times he would write these with mirror writing, so he would be, you know, writing backwards, probably to kind of add a bit of intrigue to the work. I'm not sure what Da Vinci was thinking, writing backwards. It sounds like something I would do in fifth grade or something, but still cool. And when you write it in Latin, it makes it all the better. So Da Vinci also was a well-known academic at his time, you know, so he was debating with other people and engaging in these discussions and was a kind of a public figure and seen as a, you know, a smart person that could engage on a variety of topics. You know, one thing about Da Vinci that was really bad, no, but one thing that was kind of a shortcoming is the fact that he was a perfectionist. So he left a lot of works unfinished as well. And I don't know how long the Mona Lisa took him to create, but way too long to make one portrait. You know, you can speed it up. But he took a lot of times on his project, and the reason I bring that up is because he was incredibly focused on perfection in his work, displaying all these scientific, you know, inquiries that he's doing. It kind of paves the way for this, you know, the term Renaissance man, of course, somebody who's doing engineering, somebody who's interested in philosophy, somebody who's painting, somebody who's sculpting, somebody who's making architecture, somebody who can do all of these sort of things, right? And this is all based on extremely focused study. And, you know, obviously Da Vinci was quite brilliant that he could juggle all these disciplines as well at the same time. So now let's look a little bit at the cast of characters that had to come together in order to create the masterpiece Hudson Hawk. So the director is Michael Lehman, and Michael Lehman became famous for making the movie Heathers in 1988. And this became a cult classic mainly because he has this ability to kind of blend comedy, satires, and these kind of dark narratives. So he comes off, you know, his first film is Heathers, which also has this cult-like appeal to it because of this strange intersection and ability that Michael Lehman had. At the time, the writers for Hudson Hawk are Steven D'Souza, and that's the guy who wrote Commando in 1985, Arnold Schwarzenegger film, and then, of course, Die Hard in 1988. And in addition to D'Souza, you're going to also have Daniel Waters co-writing the film, and that's the guy who wrote Heathers. So we have Lehman working with his original writer who writes this dark satire teen comedy, and he's working with the guy who previously wrote Die Hard and Commando. This sounds like a great idea. Who are we going to have be the main lead of this beautiful creation that these two people bring together? None other than Bruce Willis. And Bruce Willis is kind of the perfect person that encapsulates all these people's ideas, because he's tough. He's known as the, you know, John McClane in Die Hard. He's known as a tough, established action hero. But he's also kind of comedic. And of course, his past work on Moonlighting, where he played a private detective with Cybill Shepherd. He was kind of a pretty boy then, so he's got a lot of appeal in different directions and from different perspectives. Now, what does this have to do with painting? And I'm going to tell you right now, it has to do with intent. I'm showing you that the people that created Hudson Hawk were intending to make a good film, and they had all the things in place that one would consider would be needed to create a good film. So the film begins with a man riding on a donkey. He's riding up a hill, and we see a castle, and the side of the castle explodes. And inside that castle is Leonardo da Vinci, and he is working on this giant equestrian statue called the Sforza horse. Now, this was a real commission that da Vinci wanted to do, but due to various, you know, political problems and money problems, mainly the shortage of bronze. So there's also this aspect of Da Vinci trying to use alchemical processes to create more bronze. He didn't get to finish this statue. However, there are sketches of this statue, and there's writings about it. So we know that he wanted to create it. Anyway, getting back to the film, we zoom into Da Vinci's studio, and it's this absolutely beautiful space full of all these strange alchemical processes and explosions, and there's steam-powered machines, you know, made of elaborate wood-cut patterns, all coalescing in these strange geometric patterns. And we focus in on Leonardo da Vinci, the man surrounded by all of his assistants. And he is trying to turn lead into gold. And he's doing so by using a crystal that he puts into this crystal holder thingy above one of these contraptions. And the sun comes in through the window and hits the crystal and bounces all over the place, and some fires happen. And what is melted into this little cast is then broken, and we all see that he has created gold. And this was a really common pursuit that a lot of painters would do, and they're associated with playing with mercury and playing with chemicals. You know, of course, now in our paints we have cadmium and alizarin and all these sorts of different chemicals. We might not really think about them, but back then artists were often exploring with all these different chemicals in order to get different colors. You know, for instance, purple was very difficult and hard to get a hold of. So this idea of alchemy and the painter has been closely intertwined for a long time. And if you want to read a really good book about it, I'd recommend What Painting Is by James Elkins, which really dives deeper into this entire concept. So let's get back to the movie. So Da Vinci has successfully turned lead into gold. And after he does so, he kind of thinks, maybe I should, you know, keep quiet about this idea. So his sketches in the codices, he kind of, you know, closes his sketchbook, and he takes apart the crystal thingy and begins to hold it in his hands. He then goes outside, and he has one of his assistants strapped to one of his flying machines, and he just kind of chucks his assistant, who clearly does not want to participate in this flight lesson. He just throws him off the side of the castle wall, basically, and he starts floating around. From there, we cut to modern day, and we're introduced to Hudson Hawk, who's just getting out of prison for cat burglary, and pretty much everybody is against him. The mafia is against him. Even his own parole officer, as he's leaving prison, is trying to convince him to rob this auction house. But eventually, he does get blackmailed into robbing this museum and the Schwarza statue. So he has to bust in, and using his very lo-fi techniques, such as scooting around on a skateboard and literally just running away with the Schwarza. It's, of course, you know, it's like a maquette of the Schwarza. And he runs away, and the mafia gets it, and they break the Schwarza, and inside are the crystals, the same crystals that Da Vinci used to turn lead into gold. So as you can see, there's a lot of twists and turns in this movie, and there's a lot of different genres being investigated, but they're kind of self-aware of what they're doing. It's hard to categorize this film. Is it a heist movie? Is it a comedy? Is it an action movie? Is it a spoof of an action movie? Is it a love story? It's kind of all these things at the same time. Is it a musical? They're even, you know, they're singing songs while they're robbing these places. Instead of, you know, timing their watches, they're singing these songs. So it takes all of these genres and blends them into this stew. And for a lot of people, they didn't like it. This did not do well at the box office. But you know what else didn't do well while he was creating was Da Vinci. Da Vinci's work was not exactly widely received well at the time it was being created. He was working locally in Florence, and his work didn't really make it out that much. And these are pretty small towns at the time. We were talking, you know, 60,000, 70,000 people in them. And also, a lot of people thought his approach was goofy. They were like, why are you trying to put science into art, into painting? You're not a scientist. What are you? You're cutting up bodies? You're cutting up bodies and muscles and looking at them like you're a doctor or something? You're supposed to paint pictures, right? So his work wasn't exactly, you know, while he was considered, you know, an academic, an important member of the community, obviously, his work wasn't exactly well received at the time either. And a lot of that had to do with the experimentation in his approach. And these unorthodox techniques kind of expose how a lot of institutions operate. We might not think about them, but there's an accepted way to make paintings, there's an accepted way to make movies, and we create institutions, we create industries which perpetuate a certain way of making stuff. And when somebody doesn't make something the way that industry is supposed to make something and the way they've been making something, that also begins to intimidate people too. So other artists, other directors, they're going to pile on the hate when they see somebody creating something in an orthodox manner. Because a very ambitious vision is a direct threat to the way they create and the way they make money. So both Hudson Hawk and Leonardo da Vinci's works are born out of really ambitious visions. They aim to create groundbreaking inventions and artistic masterpieces that push the boundaries of their respective fields. And oftentimes with any sort of creative exploration, you have to be able to flop. And when we look at Da Vinci's sketchbooks, we're often thinking about how smart he was and how amazing it is that he's looking at the body in this way and taking the body apart and looking at each muscle and figuring out, oh, this muscle inserts here and then goes to there. That's all kind of amazing. And we look at his inventions like the flying machine, which of course gets recreated in the film Hudson Hawk as well. But we look at that flying machine and we might forget that that flying machine didn't work, right? When Da Vinci made it, it was still fantasy. It was still somebody just sketching in their notebook, in their sketchbook in some ways. And while we like to pile all this legend onto the persona of who Leonardo da Vinci is, at the end of the day, he needs to be creative and have a space where he can fail and make something like a ridiculous flying machine, which essentially just looks like a giant hawk. He should have that space to be able to create that sort of thing. Just as Hudson Hawk was given space and money and time and actors to create the film that they wanted to create. And sometimes when a movie like Hudson Hawk is made, or when paintings are made by Leonardo da Vinci, they get really bad reception, as we talked about. They get a mixed reception from the audience, which they're attempting to make things for. And that brings up another interesting question of who are we making art for? And when is it okay to kind of be true to your own artistic vision? And when is it okay to listen to what an audience wants? And, you know, often with film, it would be difficult to make a film like Hudson Hawk today, because there would be so many people that would say, this is a bad idea. You should not be making this movie. And then, you know, they would get a committee of writers in, and they would all try to write it in different ways and change the script. And they'd make it less jarring and strange, and it would probably turn into complete garbage. And all of this relates to social media as well, in the way that artists use social media today. Anybody can click on that analytics tab and look at exactly how well their last post did, and they could even be looking at information about when to post. How many times a day do you think Leonardo da Vinci would post? Do you think he would post, you know, would he curate his feed? Or do you think he would post, like, pictures of his bread and butter on the table, like, nicely lit in the corner of his studio? Would he mix it up like that? You know, so we don't think about this, but it's an obvious elephant in the room where we're getting direct feedback from an audience in terms of graphics that we can look at. And we're basing our content, often, many artists are basing the content that they create based upon these metrics. Think about how that relates to artists that you look up to from the times of old, like Leonardo da Vinci or Bruce Willis in Hudson Hawk. Oftentimes it's said that works like these are ahead of their time, and a movie like Hudson Hawk gets cult-like status decades after its release, even though it was a complete flop at the box office when it came out. Da Vinci's work, similarly, would also get more than just a small cult status, obviously, but it would gain a lot more recognition, and it would resonate differently many years after its creation. And I don't mean this to mean that artists should hide away in their studios and refuse to engage with society and just think of themselves as, oh, nobody understands me, right? Because there is something to be said for engaging with reality and engaging with right now and with what is happening right now with your work and with the people looking at it. But at the same time, we also have to accept the reality that in 50 years, the things that you paint might be seen in a completely different way, and they might resonate in a completely different manner. Somebody might find all of your work and put together a cohesive text about it, and that brings it to life. In the case of Da Vinci, he, of course, would go on to inspire a wide range of artistic talents, including Raphael, Michelangelo, Albrecht Dürer. Hudson Hawk would go on to influence films such as Pulp Fiction and Wes Anderson's Bottle Rocket, both which blended slapstick comedy, quirky one-liners, self-awareness of their own genre, and violence into their films, and they would refine it more, and that would become popular as a certain genre that would kind of change film forever. And similarly, Da Vinci would change painting forever and change science forever. So at the end of Hudson Hawk, we see one of Da Vinci's flying machines flying off into the sky. I won't give any spoilers as to who is navigating it. But when we see that machine flying into the sky, I think it would be nice to think that this machine embodies the audacious creativity and taking risks that both Da Vinci and Hudson Hawk did in the creation of their respective works. Thanks for listening to episode 14 of the Painting Podcast. If you like this sort of thing, head on over to oko.academy and learn more about my mentorship program. I do one-on-one in real life mentorship in Prague, Czech Republic, and I also do some mentorship online as well. So you can check both of those things out. So thanks for listening to this episode of the Painting Podcast. And as always, happy painting.